It's a great time to be an entrepreneur, and it's always a great time. But I'm wondering, what we're seeing, though, what it feels like is that to get backing from an established venture firm, you're going to have done some work, and you're going to have to put some money into your company. Now, maybe you go the angel route, but I also have a sense that it probably helps if you've done something before and you have some money to help fund your effort. Is it possible for the proverbial two guys in the garage to get funding today to do what to solve some of these great technological problems you're talking about?
I think so. I think there's an interesting new book that just came out recently. I think it's called Why Most Things Fail. And its premise is most everything fails, not just companies. You take the biggest companies in the world in the early part of the 1900s, and not just any company, but the biggest companies in the world, 100 biggest companies, and something like 19 of them were around 30 years later. In evolution, most things fail. And you just have to be so incredibly creative and innovative to succeed that it's just hard. Two guys in a garage with a new idea. They're facing tough odds, and there's a high likelihood they would fail. But I think venture capital is organized to look at the bigness of the idea and the strength of that team and place its bet and get a better chance by looking at either the plan they have or the track record they have. So, of course, track record helps. But I think venture capital is beautifully organized to take the chance on two guys in a garage and lead to success through experimentation.
I'd also say that it's easier today than it has been in any time in the last 5 years to get two guys in a garage funded. I mean, many of the companies that, you know, if I look at the stuff that I've been involved in the last 24 months, you know, many of those companies were one to four people at the time that we funded them.
Were they people who had worked in a previous startup, or were they people that literally just came off?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, I funded a company in 2004 in the spring called NewsGator. It was one guy, Greg Reinecker, who was the founder. You know, he had created a product for plugging into Outlook to read RSS. He had a vision for something much bigger than that. You know, he'd never started a company before. He had his own little thing. He was in his mid-30s and, you know, was clearly, you know, one of these, you know, 100X guys on an engineering front. I mean, could look at a problem and just solve it incredibly well. He happened to be in Denver, which is my backyard, and we got to know each other, and, you know, we wrote $1 million check, and off it went. And, you know, that company today is a 60, 70-person company, and it's really, you know, really rocking. So, you know, I don't think that the constraint of never done it before is a real constraint. I think it's a filter. Right, so you know, if Greg was a knucklehead, you know, and didn't have any idea what he was doing, but had sort of a clever idea, he wouldn't get funded, right? But that dynamic's still definitely there.
Yeah, I would just add that I think capital is not an issue. There's too much capital, frankly, and without good filters, I think the big change right now for venture capital, you talk about how it's organized perfectly for startups. I think that's a reorganize for this new world, though, because it is more global, and I think capital flows more freely. People, ideas, products, supply chains are reorganizing around low-cost regions, people with regions with particular sources of expertise, larger markets. And so the guy in Colorado now, I think 20 years ago, they would probably consider, you know, the U.S. as kind of a big enough market. But today, it is truly a global market, and you have to think about building your company, building your expertise. Everything about building the company now is more global. And so the whole job of venture capital becomes has a global orientation towards it.
Let me, to Brad's point, and maybe Tim can chime in on this as well, but Scott, you guys you were early on going into China. To Brad's point about, you know, it's a big deal for him to get from Colorado to California, and it feels like it wasn't even that long ago that you would hear venture capitalists say, oh, geez, you know, if I have to drive more than 20 minutes, then, you know, I'm not going to back the company. Now suddenly we're getting on flights for 12 hours and spending 2 or 3 days in China and the like. How easy is that to do? Is it possible for everybody to be global, or is it going to be a few global firms? Where is this headed?
How easy is it to do? It's much easier to do that than going to a small company in a little town in New Jersey. So I'd much rather jump on a flight to Shanghai and, you know, sit in business class and sleep versus, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles to find a little company. I think Back in 2000, a lot of people were kind of doing the frequent flyer approach, flying in and out. But things have rapidly changed on the ground in China, where all the firms you're seeing now really have localized people. So it's, I think that the challenge then becomes, how do you integrate that China operation with the U.S. operation to try to bring more of a global perspective?
So if I heard you right, if you had your choice between a similar company that was in China. Tim?
So that 12 hours is how I get caught up on my email. But it's a great trip, and actually, the world has opened up, and different regions have different areas of expertise, different costs of living, different ways of operating, different markets, and the more exposure you have to that global market, the better off you are going to be as an investor, because you're going to see that, something's going on in China. There's some interesting opportunity in China. But you say, we could get that done in India for about half the price. Or you go to the Ukraine and you say, we need some very clever engineers to figure out this certain problem. And they've got some people that were trained to do the anti-Star Wars defense, and they're very clever. And they have, a great open market now and a great leader and countries taking off. I think the more you realize that the world just opened up and all the, Hotmail allowed all the geographic barriers to fall. So, all of the world is in communication with all of the world. And so anybody who's in power right now, what used to be was, if you were king, you were the king of all you purveyed, and everybody around you was whatever you wanted them to be. And now it's just the opposite. If you're the king, you have all those constituents, and they know what's happening in the country next door, or they know what's happening in America, they know what's happening in Brazil, and they're saying, hey, those guys are doing it better, let's do it that way, or let's do it a better way. And so all the geographic barriers are crumbling, and now we are all just citizens of the world, and as soon as the governments start to recognize it, we're going to really have what Bill described as, one of the great entrepreneurial opportunities in history, I think, because we're going to open up. There are going to be 6-7 billion people that are all on the web. If you come up with some new kind of software that they all want, that's going to be extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't even think we need to have the government recognize it. For venture capitalists and entrepreneurs, and we are in the midst of one of the biggest change paradigms that has ever happened in the world because of globalization. So I think it's...
I think I know what your answer is going to be this, Tim, and maybe I'll get Brad's view on this too, but can a venture firm survive or be successful just being in Silicon Valley today? Can they have just one office in Silicon Valley?
For a number of years, I'm sure you can. An isolated provincial venture fund is going to start to miss some things, and their decisions are going to be not quite as worldly, and I think over the long period of time, I think their returns will fall, no matter how big their brand, no matter how great they are. If the brand is only Silicon Valley-centric, I think they're going to have some trouble.
Brad?
Well, I've made way more money in Boulder and Denver, Colorado than I have in Silicon Valley, so I actually really encourage people to go to China and to hang out in Silicon Valley and not go, towards the east, because then there's just less people. I mean, it's the cycle that's been very interesting. Colorado's a second-tier market at best in the U.S., and Boulder, Denver is a pretty vibrant area, and it's been fascinating to watch East Coast and West Coast firms try to rationalize making investments. Forget about even putting people near the geographies, but even just making investments in those geographies. And so to the extent that there is less, you know, on the money supply side, to the extent that the money is less available, it actually creates better opportunities for people like me or firms like ours that are willing to put people in geographies that are off the beaten track. So I think that the phenomena has two vectors. One is, I completely agree with the globalization, and the internet, and Skype is such a great example of it because of just how it evolved and how it happened. But there's many, many other examples where, you know, there's all this talk about Web 2.0 and all of these companies that sprout up from, you know, the entrepreneur who's done it two or three times, and they talk about how they have 20 or 30 or 40,000 users, and there's the same 25,000 users over and over again, you know, that try each of these services one time. So, you know, getting from that 25,000 users to, you know, 2.5 million users requires, you know, having geography melt away and be irrelevant. But the actual creation of the company and where the people are centered and how that talent gets organized, there's still huge value of there being localization there, whether it be in Colorado or New Jersey or Shanghai. And, you know, you can't get away from the notion that having clusters of people when you're going from 0 to 50 or 0 to 100, having them in one place, close together, working day in and day out on a powerful problem that's big, is what the key driver is, not that they're able to spread themselves all over the place.
I think that's it's a great example. We had an investment in a company called Alibaba that went up against eBay and basically won. And the reason was that they were localized. And
they were in China, right?
In China. Yep. It was, for all intents and purposes, you can think of it as the eBay of China. And Yahoo bought them. But they had a very localized team that focused on the China market. The eBay approach was to kind of bring the corporate way of doing online auction to China. Didn't work. So I think you're right. You do have to have that sensitivity as well. You globalization with localization. It's a more complicated problem.
You know, Scott said something. He said there's too much money out there for venture capital. I totally disagree. And the reason is that this is one of those enormous opportunities. And if you're talking about maybe the Silicon Valley, sure, maybe it's almost a perfect market. But I can't believe entrepreneurship wouldn't break out of a perfect market. But think about this. The world has just opened up. Everybody has access to search any search engine. And so we've all got perfect information. This, you know, a startup can happen anywhere in the world, and through the creativity of any people in the world, and we're going to need capital to support this. We're going to need to drive this. And I guess venture capital in China grew something like 35% last year or something. I don't think that's enough.